President Donald Trump recently signed an executive order requiring colleges and universities that receive federal funding to guarantee protections for free speech on campus. It's a move that the president first mentioned in 2017 when protests led the University of California at Berkeley to cancel a planned speech by the controversial conservative speaker Milo Yiannopoulos. Now, Erwin Chemerinsky is a dean of UC Berkeley's law school and an expert on the issue of free speech issues on college campuses. He recently visited the University of Hawaii's Richardson Law School and stopped by the HPR studios to talk with the conversation's Ryan Finnerty.
The First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. This has been taken to mean, quite broadly, that the ability of a person to express himself or herself, the ability of a person to read what the person wants, to view what the person chooses, is generally protected by the Constitution. It's not an absolute right. Long ago, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said there's no right to falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, but it's certainly regarded as one of the most fundamental and precious liberties.
College campuses, universities, have always been held up as a bastion of free thought and new ideas. But in the modern day, we've seen accusations that has eroded a little bit.
I think that college campuses should be the epitome of the place where freedom of speech occurs. It should be the place where all ideas and views get expressed. But controversies over free speech on campus are not new. In the early 1950s, during the McCarthy era, professors were fired, students were expelled just for being suspected of being communist. In the 1960s, there were protests on campus all across the country. At Berkeley, there was the free speech movement, which is about students wanting to be able to have speech unrelated to campus activities. Administrators were trying to stop it. When I was in college, there were the anti-Vietnam War protests, and colleges trying to stop those. So I think it's a mistake to think that today, all of a sudden, we've discovered that there's problems and issues with regard to free speech on campus.
And what form do those issues take in the modern day?
Well, many things make it different today than it used to be. One of those things is often now it's outsiders wanting to come onto campus and use the college or university as a platform for their speech. And so one of the high-profile instances that occurred a couple of years ago was Milo Yiannopoulos wanting to come onto the UC Berkeley campus and an outside group, Antifa, wanting to stop him. Where just last month there was an incident where an outsider to the Berkeley campus, a conservative, was trying to gather signatures, and an outsider to the Berkeley campus came and punched him after a verbal altercation. Neither of these individuals were faculty, staff, or students. It just by coincidence happened to occur on the Berkeley campus. I also think that there is a difference with regard to student attitudes. There's a survey by the Pew Research Institute that found that 43% of undergraduates believe that campuses should prohibit and punish offensive or hateful speech. I admire the impulse. This is the first generation to be taught from a young age that bullying is wrong, and they've internalized that message. On the other hand, I think often it's not with an awareness of the importance of free speech or the history of suppression of speech on college campuses.
What are the risks of this type of, I don't know, suppression might be too strong of a word, but of this type of activity?
I believe, as I said to you, the campuses should be places where all ideas and views can be expressed. To me, it seems very dangerous if a campus is going to say that certain ideas and views are beyond the pale and can't be expressed. That ultimately it puts an enormous trust in campus administrators. I don't have that trust. I much rather would put trust in freedom of speech than trust in government officials.
And so what is the preferable way of doing business then?
I believe that campuses should be open to all ideas and views. That said, of course, campuses can have time, place, and manner restrictions in terms of where and when speech occurs. They can have time, place, and manner restrictions during disruption of campus activities. They can have time, place, and manner restrictions so as to protect safety of faculty, staff, and students. That said, free speech is not absolute. There are instances where speech crosses the line. There's no right to threaten somebody. If speech causes a person to reasonably fear for imminent danger to his or physical safety, that's not protected by the First Amendment. Harassing speech is not protected by the First Amendment. And there's, of course, going to be difficult questions of how to draw the line of what's a true threat or what's harassment.
President Trump recently signed an executive order that he said was intended to preserve free speech on college campuses. What does that consist of?
Interestingly, the executive order says almost nothing. It simply declares that the Office of Management and Budget and all federal agents should make sure that college universities that receive federal funds should protect, quote, freedom of inquiry. Of course, we're all in favor of freedom of inquiry. I think this is likely unconstitutional because it doesn't tell us what the conditions are. The law is clear whenever the federal government's going to put strings on federal money, it has to be clear about what the conditions are. This doesn't do that. Also, I think the president can't set these conditions. Only Congress can put conditions on federal money. I also think that it's undesirable because no campus administrator can tell from this language what it is that would jeopardize federal funds. No campus administrator can know what behavior is appropriate or what behavior isn't allowed under the executive order. It's simply too vague.
One of the most interesting developments in this whole debate over the last few years for me has been the rise of high-profile comedians who are now choosing not to play on college campuses. Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock were two of the biggest names. And that was particularly interesting to me because they're not inherently political in any way, but they are still running into these issues.
I think it's sad to hear of Jerry Seinfeld or Chris Rock not wanting to appear on college campuses. I think it's about something different than what we're discussing. It's not about the campus prohibiting them from coming. It's that when they say things that offend people, now on campuses, students will speak up and say, "We're offended." I don't mind students doing that. We all learn from a young age there's certain things we shouldn't say to others or say in public. Students are very sensitive right now, and if a comedian comes onto campus, like Jerry Seinfeld or Chris Rock, they're taking a risk that if they say something that offends people, those who are offended are going to speak out. I'd rather Seinfeld and Rock and others just have a thicker skin and come and take it, but obviously they don't want to.
Now, there's a similar situation where students have circulated petitions or expressed widespread opposition to certain speakers. I believe Condoleezza Rice was in that position a few years ago. She was going to be giving maybe a commencement address or some other type of speech at a campus, and enough students vocalized opposition to her presence that she decided to leave voluntarily. That seems to be, it's not the university saying, "We don't want this person." She was invited by the university, but then the students are kind of dictating what happens.
I want to draw a distinction between the students speaking up against have somebody on campus and the students disrupting a speaker on campus. The former seems to me an exercise of free speech. The latter is unacceptable. If students want to sign a petition and say, "We don't want this person speaking at our commencement," that's the student's First Amendment right to do it. Campus officials can then decide how they want to respond. The speaker can decide how he or she wants to respond. But that's just students exercising their free speech right. If what the students are doing is engaging in speech that's not disruptive, that's protected by the First Amendment. I have no problem with the students signing a petition saying, "The person you invited to speak at commencement is unacceptable to us." What I'm saying isn't permissible under the First Amendment is for students to disrupt a speaker. And so if a speaker is shouted down so that he or she can't speak, that's not protected by the First Amendment.
I guess what I was describing is perhaps not in violation of the First Amendment, but there is a perception out there that there is a suppression of ideas on college campuses, whether or not it's in violation of a law. And it seems like the disallowing of certain speakers on campuses would kind of fall into that category, which is kind of antithetical to what a university should be about.
And there, too, it's an important distinction, though a different one that we were just discussing. The First Amendment says that the government can't take any action to suppress speech, subject to exceptions. On the other hand, there's often social pressures not to speak. And I worry within the classroom that there may be social pressures on students not to take certain positions. I worry that within the context of the university, those social pressures exist. And one of the things that I worry about as an administrator is what can I do so as to combat those social pressures so that students feel comfortable expressing all ideas and views.
Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California, Berkeley Law School, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And the dean was recently in Hawaii to speak at the UH Richardson School of Law.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra presenting Brass Transit, performing music of Chicago, including songs such as Saturday in the Park, this Friday at the Blaisdell. HawaiiSymphonyOrchestra.org.
Aquan McElrath. I love how the name just rolls off your tongue. And if you don't know her, well, maybe you should. She made her mark on the labor scene here in the islands as an advocate for social justice. Chris Conybeare is with the faculty of CLEAR, the Center for Labor Education and Research at the University of Hawaii West Oahu campus. He's also the executive producer of the documentary film about this local labor leader, Aquan McElrath.
Aquan McElrath is one of the great leaders in our history. Aquan, because she was a woman, an immigrant, a first generation, she maybe didn't get the credit that some of our well-known politicians and others have, but she was the one who helped devise the strategies that brought about the first multiracial union in Hawaii, the ILWU. She's the one that basically stood up to a lot of pressure from the Big Five, from corporate interests, and from others, and said, no, we have to change the way we treat the working people of Hawaii. And at the time when she came up, the working people of Hawaii were treated very badly. They were basically serfs. They had accounts at the company store that were never paid off. They were paid very little. They had no control over their working hours or conditions. Aquan helped change all that.
And so really, this was an important part of Hawaii history, with plantation history. She stands out.
Not only that history, but when she retired in 1980, she spent the next 30 years fighting for housing and for rights for seniors and death with dignity and health care and all kinds of other social and economic justice matters, including a free press. So she spent her entire life basically working to help better the social and economic conditions of the people of the state.
And I remember covering her during my time in TV news, and as I was looking at some of the clips that you've provided, it was just kind of nice to kind of listen to her voice again and it kind of take you back to that time.
Basically, Aquan realized from her own childhood, she was extremely poor. Her father and mother were immigrants from China. Her father died while she was a young girl, leaving her mother with, like, I think 5 or 6 kids. And her mother had bound feet and was almost blind. So that family grew up on their own. They did everything they could to make money. They picked rags, they traded things, they collected kukui nuts, they did anything they could to bring in income. And one of the things Aquan did, in addition to all that, is she put herself through college. She worked 3 or 4 jobs and started at the University of Hawaii back in the 30s. And because of her background and what she saw and how she perceived life here, she decided things had to change.
So you are trying to preserve that story, to tell that story.
We notice, I mean, we're based at the University of Hawaii at West Oahu, but we know that students today don't really know this history. It's not really well taught in our educational system. The struggle of the immigrants who came here to work on the plantations, the struggle of the Hawaiians who are already here, and not just the plantations, but on the docks and in various businesses. At one time, they were controlled by 5 corporations in Hawaii called the Big Five. Even to the point that plantation managers would know how people voted because they had strings hanging down from the ceiling, and they could tell if you moved the string to the right, you were voting for the Democrats, or moved it to the left, you were voting for the Republicans. And your manager might come up to you afterwards and say, you're not voting right. You want to keep your job here? So even up to how you're going to vote, if you even had the right to vote, were controlled by others. And so what Aquan and her colleagues did was to help organize people to fight against that kind of oppression.
So your hope is to be able to, not just to preserve what we've got as far as digital images and all of that, but then to put it in a format that those stories continue to be told and taught in the classroom.
Exactly. Our goal is to use Akhwan's very compelling story as a gateway to a lot of other stories. We're going to connect it. We have more than 2,600 or almost 3,000 videotapes with interviews from people from the plantation era, the stevedores who worked on the docks, women who came here as picture brides, a whole treasure trove of material that will be linked to this documentary via website, so that people who are interested in any aspect of it can then come back, click on a link, and get a full-length interview from, say, one of the people who appears in the documentary. And as you know from your time in news, the amount of time on screen might be 20 seconds, but we might have an hour interview with somebody. So we're going to try to make all that available.
Now, when you were last here in our studios, you were talking about the sugar plantation days, and you did a documentary about Maui that was then used as a resource for a book, the swim club, the three-year swim club. But that focus on the history, that project, you were able to get some money to help digitize some
right.
of those things.
So the good news is we've gotten the money to digitize a lot of this material. Without that, we wouldn't have been able to probably even embark on this documentary. The problem now is turning all of that, those resources, into a world-class documentary, a system of video excerpts that will be used in classrooms, both from K through 12, plus in the university system, and then this website that will link all of that material I talked about, so that full-length interviews with picture brides, full-length interviews with longshoremen, full-length interviews with women who worked in the pineapple canneries, for instance, all of that will be available.
Okay, so you're basically launching a campaign to be able to fundraise either private donations or private foundations.
Exactly. I mean, we do have a grant and aid request at the legislature. I don't know what will happen with that. But the main thing is we are trying to save a hidden history. We know names in our history. We know names like Burns, and we know names of famous politicians and all of that. But AQ, Akhwan's nickname, she worked with a group of people that really changed the face of Hawaii. And they had names like Sleepy and Pinhead and Mustard and Cotton and Dynamite and whatever. And these were the ordinary working people in the fields, on the docks, and they actually helped bring about these changes.
And those stories of those people deserve to be preserved, along with the Burns.
Along with the high-profile politicians and others, and maybe even more so. Because without them, without the organizing that Akhwan and her colleagues did, we might not have been able to change that system. They were part of that whole move to bring a democratic process to Hawaii. You know, as they say, if you don't know your history, you might repeat the bad parts. So we're trying to tell people that somebody like Akhwan, who had started out with nothing, was dirt poor, with resolve, intellect, and a clear direction of ethical responsibility, was able to make great changes and help others make great changes. And we think anybody can. We'd like people to be inspired by this woman. I was, and I know many people that know about Akhwan, but I'm afraid the current generation, they don't anymore. We have to remind them.
And so the nut that you have to crack.
Basically, right now we need $200,000 for the documentary. We're working on other money that will create the website and the curriculum development pieces. In fact, Thursday I'm going to the East Coast to Amherst College, where Franklin Odo, who used to head the Ethnic Studies Department here, is now a professor, and they're going to help us with some money and also help create some of the curriculum development pieces that we can use, not just in Hawaii, because this is not just a local story. We see this as an international story, a national story.
We've been hearing from Chris Conybeare, executive producer of the documentary film about the life of labor leader Akhwan McElrath. We'll have links to the project and more on how to contact Chris on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Report for Hawaii Public Radio. Radio comes from Kilauea Lodge in Volcano Village, Hawaii Island, offering accommodations and an on-site restaurant featuring daily pauhana from 2 to 5 p.m. KilaueaLodge.com.
You are back with The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. And joining us for today's reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat is political and opinion editor Chad Blair. He has an update on where we're at the state legislature as we head into the final weeks of session. One bill in particular, raising the minimum wage, is of great interest. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So where are we at with this second crossover at the ledge?
Yeah, that deadline is tomorrow, and then May 2nd, of course, is the pauhana day, I call it. That's when the session concludes, at least the 2019. There are actually two bills regarding the minimum wage. Now, when we started the session back in January, everybody was talking about this is the year, we got to raise it. Currently, our minimum wage is now capped out at $10.10 an hour, and so many other places are going much higher. Obviously, Hawaii also has an expensive cost of living. So what happened yesterday is the Senate approved a House bill, that's HB 1191, that raises the wage from $10.10 to $15 an hour by the year 2023. It would be phased in. There's also a plan in that same bill for a $17 an hour minimum wage by 2023, but that's only for full-time state employees. And one other thing that bill would do, it would provide an income tax credit to help small businesses, which of course will be impacted by this increase. Many of them oppose it. Then quickly, the other bill is Senate Bill 789. That bill was approved by the House. A little more complicated. It initially was going to raise the wage to $15 by 2024. Guess what? Now that dollar amount is blank. And you've covered the ledge. You know how this works. Often they will leave dollar amounts blank because they're going to work it out in conference. There's also a separate wage increase in this bill, the Senate bill, for employers that are not required to provide health insurance for part-time workers, but they do. As you remember, we have mandatory prepaid health care for full-time workers. So that's to help them out. What it does not hold, contain, is any kind of help for businesses, any kind of tax credit. One other thing, the Senate bill also would require that people with disabilities be paid more money. Right now, you can actually limit how much you pay minimum wage wise to people with disabilities. Boy, did I get through that all? Okay.
Yeah. So it'll be worked out in conference committee likely. What are the other biggies that are either advancing or dying?
I was a little surprised at the bill to decriminalize marijuana if you have 3 grams or less to be a penalty, something like $30. I can't remember what the last figure was. It would also, if it gets passed and signed into law, expunge people's records. You know, we started the session with a legalization of marijuana. That bill is dead. But the decrim, much to my surprise, made it pass the Senate, in all likelihood going into conference committee.
And I know there's a biggie, a struggle over the water rights, the permits issue.
That's putting it mildly, Catherine. Yes. Bottom line, there was some drama yesterday behind closed doors. The bill was not pulled to the Senate for a floor. I have been talking to senators all morning. We'll have an update tomorrow. But bottom line, I've used that word twice now, that phrase. It could still come up. Some senators don't want it. Some senators do. We will see. I think we're going down to the wire on this one.
Yeah, the political intrigue. Don't we just love it?
Love it indeed.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Kevin.
And Honolulu Civil Beat brings us our daily dose of reality check today, featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honolulu Waldorf School, offering an education that helps to foster clarity of thought, courage, and confidence, featuring an online auction fundraiser April 13th to 30th, honoluluwaldorf.org.
This week we're highlighting our recent call-in shows where we talk to our county mayors and newsmakers throughout the state. Today we share an excerpt from our show with Maui County Mayor Mike Victorino. It's been a whirlwind year so far for this former county council member who's no stranger to politics. We talk with him about the issues important to residents on the Valley Isle.
We see sea level rising. We see other incidents. We have, you know, Maui, we had in 2016 that tremendous rainfall with the Wailuku River, took a whole new diversion system and changed, cleared up and knocked down sides of our parks and areas that had been there for 30, 40, 50 years. So the severe weather we all have been experiencing throughout the state, throughout the world for that matter, is indicating that climate change is upon us, and we now must make what I call the infrastructure retreat along our coastline, our roadways, our sewer. Oahu is dealing, all the islands, we're all dealing with that now. We know that we don't have any time to wait. We've got to start being proactive instead of being reactive.
Well, I hope you're eating your Wheaties, because the first months have just been kind of crazy.
It is somewhat stressful to all of us, you know, especially our citizenry. I mean, we're constantly putting up warnings and asking them to be aware of what's going on around them. And again, your everyday life is stressful enough, so all of this is just added more. And whether it's Oahu, Maui, Hawaii, or Kauai, all of our counties have been facing some real challenges when it comes to weather. And I thank everyone and again, anyone listening throughout the state, just always heed emergency services warnings and make sure whatever the officials say you need to do, try to do it, because you want to keep out of harm's way.
Good point. I must say your first responders had another challenge over at the Maui Community Correctional Center. We talked to Public Safety Director Nolan Espinda about that riot at the facility. Again, your county fire and police helped to respond to, and he did mention that he stopped in to talk to you.
Yes. And let me start and go back to the incident itself. I would like to say that, yes, the overcrowdedness in these facilities really did bring it to the forefront. And I think we've been dealing with that for years. But it got to a boiling point, and there were some that went over the edge and created an unsafe condition, not only for themselves, but also for those who did not participate. And from my understanding, from both people in and outside of that system, many were not active participants, but they were trapped within the whole issue itself. And so I want to, first of all, recognize our police negotiators. I think I want to give credit to them for their defusing of the situation, getting those who were the instigators calmed down to be able to set things up so that people and the inmates, as well as the ACOs and our police department, were able to handle the situation in a very orderly, calm, and non-violent manner. So I want to give them a lot of credit and thank them so very much for what they did. So as you can see, the result was not one that you've seen in other places where injuries ran rampant and also fatalities may have occurred. So first, let's recognize that. Secondly, the damage that was done by some of these instigators was quite extensive, and you've seen the pictures, right?
Yes.
And so with that being said, repairs and necessary changes have to be made. Now we go to the real crux of the problem, is the fact that we are overcrowded. We have for years discussed about moving the facility from where it's landlocked now, surrounded by a cemetery on one side, a reservoir in the back, Kahalia Keola, which is a transitional home based program for people in need to transition back out into the working workforce, and across the street, which is all residential housing. There's no place else to move. There's no place else to grow. There's no place else to develop within this area. So we had looked at Punane. The Punane complex was well on its way, but for a number of reasons, I'm not blaming anyone. I never like to point fingers, because, you know, it's easy to point, it's harder to find solutions. But we know we now have to do something, and have to do something quite expediently. I mean, we need to move on it, and there's not enough time to talk about it. So I have been in conversation with the governor. We will look at seeing what we can do right now to rectify as best as possible what we have here, and to really look for a new facility that is probably 15, 20 years overdue. And so you have my assurances from the county. I stand ready to help the state and whomever else is a part of this to put not only effort, but to to expedite any permitting processes. Anything we can do from our side, I would like to be a part of and be a part of the discussion. And really, I'd like to say, quit talking. Let's get walking. Let's get this journey started to building and or improving this system. If we have to go vertical, we have to go vertical to build more units and more cubicles, and where prisoners are not four to a cell, there should be only two to a cell. And then all these other issues about whether they're talking toilets, whether they're talking about washrooms, whatever, will be taken care of. And these prisoners or these inmates or these detainees, there's a number, it falls into different categories, are properly taken care of in a humanistic way.
You're in a situation there where you can't really turn anybody away because of our current system. So lots of things to be concerned about. I did talk to a resident shortly after that incident who happened to be here in Honolulu, and she was distressed and really scared that something like this could happen. I mean, really, we had a situation where the inmates said, you know, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore, I guess.
Well, they can rest assured, our police department and the adult correctional officers were out there. The ACOs were out there, and we had the situation well in hand. Yes, it was for a while faultable. Yes, you know, we were concerned, but we made sure we had everybody in place, including our fire department, to help fight those fires in place so that it did not spill over to any residential or any other area except the facility itself. So I can tell the public, you can rest assured we were on it and we were ready to prevent anything from further moving in any other direction but in the facility itself.
Switching gears, we do have a call on the line. Amy from Kahului, good morning. What do you have on your mind? You have a question for the mayor?
Good morning, Mayor. In
good morning.
Light of last month's Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation lawsuit filed on behalf of a recognized cultural descendant, how do you respond to community concerns about the ongoing imperilment and desecration to the iwi kupuna, the ancestral skeletal remains, in the Pu'u'one, the sand dunes situated inside the Maui Lani Project District, as well as throughout Maui County? There are currently no archaeologists at the Maui State Historic Preservation Division, so there's no oversight of the developer's mass excavation activity in these highly sensitive cultural areas. Mahalo.
Well, that's a broad question, and we are working on that at this time. We're looking for the state to help us with the cultural experts and the people that are needed to be on these job sites and making sure that contractors fulfill their obligation or any development. We have asked them to cease at this point to make sure that these areas are looked upon, and we are looking into as far as the sensitivity and the cultural aspect. And no one in this community, more than myself, would like to make sure that no iwi is moved from any ethnicity, whether it's just the host culture or any other iwi that is out there. So I'm very sensitive to this, and I've been working on it. And I will say that we will soon have some ideas and some changes in legislation that we'll be bringing forward in a not-too-distant future. You know, so we have laws in place and we have policies in place, but they seem sometimes not to be followed, and that's when fines or anyhow revocable permits are the other possibilities. And so I have asked that our public works and other groups that are involved in it, our cultural commission, be more mindful of it and to keep us informed, and also SHPTA to help us in this area.
That was an excerpt from our call-in show with Maui County Mayor Mike Victorino. An example of some of the new projects we're undertaking here on The Conversation. Another reason to support Hawaii Public Radio.